This episode of Breaking Brave is brought to you by Crank Coffee, the newest member of the Neal Brothers family. Crank Coffee is a new Canadian whole bean coffee brand that is certified organic and fair trade, founded by the Neal Brothers, Peter and Chris. This brand was influenced by cycling, coffee lovers, and experts. Check it out at the Neal Brothers online shop and use our coupon code BRAVE for 20% off your first Crank Coffee purchase. Enjoy. And I wanted to mention that if you would like to connect with me directly, you can always do so at marilynbarefoot.com or breakingbrave.show. I see and answer every single contact personally, and I would truly love to hear from you. Welcome back to Breaking Brave. I'm Marilyn Barefoot, your host. Since we last spoke to my guest today, Jill Bodak, the last chapter of her book, Loved Into Being, has now been written. Jill joins me today to talk about saying goodbye to her dad, Bill Bodak, on December the 6th of 2022. His decision to access medical assistance in dying allowed him and his whole family to stop striving. And with that came a sort of wellness that accompanied the acceptance. Today, Jill and I talk about what that last day with her dad was like. And we also delve into where this last chapter with her dad has taken her, specifically wellness, mortality, and the gap between expectations and reality. Jill believes strongly in the practice of microdosing mortality, which involves integrating conversations about mortality into day-to-day wellness practices. Please join me in welcoming back the very brave Jill Bodak. Jill and I have such an incredible connection, first through the conversation we had and aired in January of 2023 regarding medical assistance in dying and Jill saying goodbye to her father on December the 6th of 2022. In fact, I wrote Jill an email saying on that day, since we recorded the episode before her father passed away, I wrote her an email on December the 6th and said I was thinking of her. Before I actually bring Jill on to say hello, I'd like to read the last chapter of Jill's book called Loved Into Being, because she hadn't written the last chapter when we last chatted because her father was still with us at the time. So if you will indulge me, and I'm going to caveat this by, if anyone hasn't yet read the book, which is entirely possible, you're going to after this episode. Jill's father, Bill Bodak, was an incredible fanatic about water skiing. So there's a reference in here that means water skiing. So thank you, Jill, for indulging me. December the 6th at 1:35 p.m. Dad let go of the rope. His last stop was the couch in our living room, wearing a tie-dye t-shirt that he chose himself. The night before, we held a candlelight vigil and hundreds of people came to our front yard to light up his last night and leave love notes for his safe passage. One person brought a picture of him water skiing, and when he lay himself down on the couch in those last moments, he wanted to be able to see it. Mom sat right near his face, Shyla and Will alongside her. I got on the couch with him, our legs alongside each other, reclining head to toe, just like we did at the start. Marla, Nana, and Dad's youngest sister sat on the couch across from us. We sang You Are My Sunshine and Bridge Over Troubled Water as we waited for the medicine to start. And when it did, we all put our hands on his chest and felt him drift into sleep, listened to him softly snore, and then heard him stop. I love you. Good job, Dad. You rest now. No more pain. The words gushed out of all of us, cheering him up, on, and out. When the doctor pronounced him dead, the room was washed with a wave of relief. I took his clay ball from the table behind us and smashed it open on the floor. Let him be free. And he is now. Jill, to be absolutely frank, I had to read that about 10 times before we jumped on this recording to make sure that I didn't absolutely lose my mind crying hysterically. Not because it was sad, but because it was so intimate and you chose to share it with the world. So welcome, Jill Bodak.
Thank you so much, Marilyn. And I closed my eyes and listened while you were reading, and I'm right there too. So thanks for really bringing us into the room and bringing us into the topic in such an immediate way.
What was that day like for you, Jill? Let's start there, and then we'll work to what's happened in your life since your dad passed.
I think by the time the day that my dad died arrived, and because of the nature of his made request being non-urgent, we had waited 90 days from the time we knew he was going to die to the day that he did die. And so the morning that it came, I feel like everyone was ready, even though it was weird. And so we all woke up together in the same house. And my dad was nervous in a way that was hard to just let him have. You know, like, of course you're nervous. This is the scariest thing you could possibly be doing. That doesn't mean he didn't want to do it. So that morning we were really navigating holding him however he felt and knowing that it wasn't our job to question his decision at that point. It was his job to just feel what he needed to feel. And it was a big day for him. And I think that was something we did really nicely, was to have enough time to be ready to let it be his day and not everyone else's day, because death is scary, and it definitely was something that frightened all of us. You know, how is it going to go? Is it going to be scary? Is it going to be traumatizing? Is it going to be intolerable? And actually, it was so sweet. So we had amazing breakfast sandwiches, and we took a lot of pictures of my dad with his two grandsons who were there, and I shaved his head one last time in the bathroom, and that was a really intimate time for us. And then, you know, around 1 o'clock, the doctors came, and we shifted into doing what we said we were going to do, and everyone followed through, and it was truly beautiful. And maybe more like how death used to be before our culture forgot how to do that at home and forgot how to do that with children in the room or with children in the vicinity. It got to be slow and family oriented and very intimate and still sad and still not what we wanted to have happen, but beautiful.
I'm really glad you said what you said about the way it used to be, because once upon a time on Breaking Brave, I interviewed Chief and now Dr. Edmund Metatawabin, and he talked about his father passing and how everybody was there and they burned sage, and his father was actually able to speak about the world, the next world, as he was transitioning into it. He didn't have any assistance with it, but he could see people that had gone before him that were waiting to welcome him. And the children in the room were there, and it wasn't scary. All of a sudden, everybody realized they weren't afraid, but the person themselves wasn't afraid. And having that shown to the children that they're going into the arms of the ones who went before. Wouldn't that be the way all of us would want to do it?
If you had a choice, don't you think?
Yeah.
And yeah. I'm so glad you said that, because it reminds me of something that I read in the course of my dad dying when I was doing my own preparing of my own grace and heart, that the generation ahead of us, one of their roles is to show us how to die. And that we've forgotten that that's actually a job that they have. It's something to honor and appreciate. It's a gift that they give. And I really thank my dad for framing his dying in a way that I will always cherish and remember and look to emulate at the end of my life, like to be celebrated, to be surrounded by family, to be calm, and to be clear about how he wanted everything to go.
Jill, can you, for people that are listening to this and have not heard our original episode, and we'll put that in the show notes so that they can, and I would encourage people to listen to that one before this one, but just to level set this conversation, why did your father, together with his surrounding family members, make the decision to reach out to MAID to end his life? Why? Because there'll be a number of people who may not understand the backstory here and haven't read your book or listened to the episode.
Sure. The story started in January of 2020 when my dad had a catastrophic stroke on a ski hill on vacation. And he was in his early 60s when that happened. And my book and the story follows us, his three children, myself and my younger two siblings, and my dad and my mom, through the immediate catastrophe of that brain injury where he was expected to die and then he didn't. So he survives this massive stroke and he lives about 2 years post-stroke where we're all heading this recovery effort. We're trying to teach him how to walk again, talk again, be able to use his right arm, understand language and communicate with us in a way that would give him some quality of life. And along the way in that recovery, he starts having very regular seizures. And so that was a turning point for us in the recovery story where we stopped gaining ground around his quality of life. And he was 63 at that time. And it was kind of like looking down another steep slope and realizing that he had already lost so much and there would be no more gaining. So at 63 years old, with assisted living and so many medications and regular seizures that would knock him out for several days at a time, he started to really lose his resolve to be alive. And in the summer of 2022, he started to make it clear to myself and his sister and his other caregivers that he couldn't try that hard anymore. And that's when we started to talk about medical assistance in dying. And he made it very clear that if that wasn't an option for him, that he would find another way to make sure he wasn't here much longer. And that frightened us all very much. So that's how we got to the process of applying for MAID in the fall of 2022, and then his medically assisted death in December of that year.
Thank you. And maybe, Jill, you could talk a little bit about the striving that we're going to teach you how to talk again. We're going to teach you how to walk again. We're going to teach you how to feed yourself again. We're going to teach you, we're going to strive. We're going to get better. We're going to strive. And that what you just referenced here around when he started to have these seizures and it became clear that he was losing ground, mm-hmm. no more striving and gaining ground. Where does that take you?
Well, there are certain ways that human beings are wired. You know, we all have the way that we are. And the way that my dad was wired to work hard, try, never quit, and just keep going. And I said to him from very, very early on after his stroke, we didn't try to keep you alive here. You're just so hard to kill. Like, you just didn't die, man. You're really something. That was him. He's like a grizzly bear. He's so hard to kill. And his striving was a part of his nature, and it was a part of how he understood what wellness is or what success is, was to go hard and push and try and always assume that we're trying to get somewhere better than where we are. And that was in his nature, and it's something that he taught me, and that attitude has gotten us both very far in our lives. But it also became a limiting factor for him post-stroke, because when you're dealing with real life, brain injuries, disability, aging, decline, there are some realities that are so hard to face if the only thing you know about how to proceed is to push harder, get higher, get better, and do more. And so there was such a reckoning for both of us around what does it mean to be well in your body when your body doesn't do what you want it to do. And we did do miraculous things in his recovery, and it totally hit a limit. And that was a big deal for both of us in our understanding of bodies and life and death and how to be.
I never had the privilege and joy of meeting your father. I feel like through reading the book and now doing two interviews with you, I somehow kind of feel connected to him. But maybe he had to do all of that hard work and striving, because otherwise he would have felt, and maybe you too, and the other family members, that you just don't give up. This is not something we do. We don't give up. Mm-hmm. But when you got to the point, he and the family got to the point, you as his primary caregiver, where I just don't want to work this hard anymore. That acceptance, according to what we've chatted about, was very peaceful for him and for other people around him.
Definitely. And to be very honest, the process of him getting to that acceptance was on the other side of a river of tears for him. So he cried for days. And this is a person that I talk about in the book, like that I never saw cry, that never had feelings or was soft or vulnerable. He was the hero. And so there was something so profound about watching the territory he had to traverse to go from the striving to the peaceful acceptance. And the tears at that time also weren't a problem. They weren't something to fix. They were a part of his transformation or a part of his healing. And it was those few days where we went from the striving and the seizures to discussing end-of-life choices were so deep for both of us. To be in the proximity of that kind of sadness, relief, I'll say giving up, but I mean it in the most generous way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe surrender in the truest, in the truest meaning of that word, in the most reverent meaning of surrender.
Absolutely. So Jill, in your practice, maybe you could tell the audience, what is your practice? What do you do for a living?
Sure. I am an osteopath in Canada, which means that I am a hands-on practitioner, sort of in the realm of physiotherapy and chiropractic and massage. Osteopaths in Canada are in the same room as those sorts of practitioners. And I've been doing that for 11 years now. Oh my gosh. And it goes really fast.
Time flies when you're doing something you're passionate about. Yep.
Totally. So over a decade, one-on-one with people in a room who are suffering in their bodies. So people come to see me because of back pain, knee pain, neck pain, but they also come because of sleep loss, menstrual disturbances, trouble with digestion, migraines, clenching their jaws, can't catch their breath, can't sleep through the night, anxious bodies. It's like my body's not doing what I want it to do. And I'm a person who specializes in helping to figure that out. And so that specialty of mine was of great service to my dad after his stroke. And we did a lot of research and we did a lot of work together to make sure that the skills that I had were
as amplified as possible in the application of his recovery. And then when I wasn't a primary caregiver anymore, I went back into my office and saw the ways that that time with him utterly altered the way that I met people one at a time in their suffering bodies, in these bodies that people bring to me where they're like, my body's not doing what I want it to do. And I'm like, yeah, I know all about that in a totally different way now.
The end of your dad's life has put you, I believe, we've talked about this, on a path that's linking your current practice with mortality.
Yeah.
And the intersection or the gap between those two worlds of wellness and the world of you can look better, you can live forever, you can have a body of a 19-year-old when you're 85 years old, you all of that that we as a generation and a society, at least in North America, seem to be striving towards. And we continue to use that word striving, yet no one lives forever. So maybe you can talk to us about your position on this or what you're doing with this two polar opposites of this society of, I want to look 19 and I want my body to be the same, to we have to face that day of reckoning and die one day.
Yeah. Thank you for framing it that way. And I think the first gap in understanding is to think that that the dying one day and the 19-year-old body live in opposite spaces or on opposite planets, or that's a polarity, you know, that your wellness is opposed to your mortality. And this is actually a way that I think commercial wellness, and I have to be careful when I say that because I make my living in the realm of wellness, in helping people to be well. And so it's provocative for me to say that the wellness industry capitalizes on the myth of immortality or capitalizes on this idea that we can run away from dying by being more and more well. And it's a misnomer of the word well because it implies that if you do wellness right, you will never get old, you'll never get ill, you'll never decline, and you'll never die. And when we frame wellness to people in that way, as though if you consume wellness properly and practice wellness properly, you'll no longer be human, we're setting people up to strive for a destination that they'll never reach. And in my office, that's what I see as one of the primary things that's stressing people out, because there's so much out there on TikTok and YouTube and Instagram and everywhere about wellness. Everyone is like, do it this way, do it that way. We understand this now. We know about that now. We can optimize and energize and habit our way to being inhuman. And when people arrive in my office, what they're saying is like, it's not working. I'm still getting old. I still get injured. I'm still slow to heal. I don't understand why I'm doing all these things. I'm going to all the appointments and I'm taking all the supplements and I'm doing my Pilates and I'm seeing my personal trainer and I'm doing my deep breathing and I've got all the apps. And I'm still living in a body. And my body changes over time. And sometimes it hurts and it gets ill. And at a certain point, the trajectory of my physical body isn't upward. And that is so inspiring to me right now because I think that there's an opportunity to redefine or reimagine what it means to be well by having mortality as a central pillar, like a fundamental element of wellness is to root ourselves in our humanity, which means including the realities of our human body as a part of our efforts to be well.
And that doesn't mean give up. that doesn't mean stop exercising, pick up the pack of cigarettes again, you know, sit around on the couch and eat bad food and because I'm going to die anyway. So what's the point? That is not the point. It's the intersection of yes, do all these things because you're going to feel better and your life is going to be better and you're going to be happier and you'll be able to spend time with your grandchildren in an active, interesting, fun way.
Well, I love that you brought in that perspective because it's like saying, I can't do this forever, so let's have a horrible time the rest of the way. You know, like if I'm going to die anyways, then might as well feel horrible is one way you could deal with that reality. But an alternative that I'm suggesting is to, I call it microdosing mortality. And microdosing mortality is kind of like a homeopathic level of remembering that our lives are finite and our bodies are fragile and they need care. And when we drop in that little bit of mortality into our decision-making around our bodies or our wellness, I think it gives us access to our aliveness. And that's what I saw at the end of my dad's life, when we started to embrace his mortality, embrace the reality of how tired he was and how fragile he was and how little time he had left with us. That was a macro dose of mortality, but what it gave us was a macro dose of aliveness, of the kind of presence and tenderness and poignancy that we all long for in our mundane lives. Like we're moving through the world, staring at screens and in a hurry to get everything done. And we lose track of our aliveness because we forget about our bodies. And when we forget about our bodies, we forget about our humanness and our mortality. And that is the space that sprouts the kind of aliveness that makes us experience all the best parts of being a human, the joy, the connection, the lightheartedness that has nothing to do with being skinny or being fit. It has to do with being a vibrant human who gets to feel what humans are capable of in the brief time that we have here. And that's what came alive for my dad. His capacity to connect came alive when we stopped trying to change what his body could do.
But this is hard for human beings. And people are kind of curious about the topic of death. Mm-hmm. They always have been. I'm sure they always will because it's not, well, to the best of my knowledge, and yes, I believe in an afterlife and an afterworld. And in fact, we had our house ghost busted before we actually bought it. But we've not personally gone through this before. So there's that, I'm a little scared. I'm a little uncomfortable. People don't want to talk about death. Mm. I don't know. Why don't people want to talk about this? Because maybe you're starting to push that a little bit with, you know, hey, not everybody's going to live forever. How do you try and have these conversations with people, Jill?
Well, I think it's easier for me because I work in a constant context of centering the body. And when someone brings me a body, it's not so hard to be like, do you understand what this is? You know? But let's work on the way we understand what this machine is. Primarily, it's alive, which means that it also dies. And how do we start to make contact with that in a way that's not overwhelming and that doesn't make us jettison? And it is trickier in the corporate world or, you know, in the fullness of city life or whatever, in the busyness of what it means to be alive in 2024, it's harder to make contact with that until it kind of like sideswipes you. Someone you love or someone dear to you gets ill or dies suddenly. And then all of a sudden, you're macro dosing mortality when you've been completely out of touch with it for so long. So my suggestion is that micro dosing is a mortality is a way to start to increase your window of tolerance to something that you're going to make contact with in a much larger way, at least once, but probably several times in the course of a life, will you be swimming in that territory of grief and loss that totally pulls you out of your regular routine. You know, those times in our lives where you're not doing regular work anymore, you're doing the dying of a loved one or you're doing major illness.
Yeah.
And I also think that as much as people don't want to talk about death, we can say that as sort of a generalism. There is a growing population of people really longing to include death. It's been called the death positivity movement. In New York Magazine, I believe, even wrote about like death is having a moment. There's an uprising of death awareness and wanting to do death differently, wanting to engage with grief differently, and death doulas and a whole sort of like bubbling space for the death conversation. And I think that death conversation is desperate for a larger audience. And it's my belief, strong belief, that the audience that they're looking for is everyone in wellness. And it's the wellness population that really needs the wellness industry and everyone that it serves needs to shake hands with the mortality people, because we can actually offer something to one another. Wellness can be brought into end-of-life care, and mortality can be taken towards the world of wellness as a way to access our aliveness. They have to go together. And the fact that we've pulled them apart is a disservice to our bodies and ultimately only serves capitalism, busyness, and productivity, you know, to dissociate from our humanness in that way. Those are the only gains.
You mentioned something. What is a death doula? I know what a doula is when a woman is going to give birth. I don't know what a death doula is.
Death doulas are not new in the same way that birth doulas are not new. But in recent years, there's been a real uptick in our awareness of and maybe need or use for people that are there to be of service and help with the crossing over or the peaceful ending of lives, to help us do death. Because many of us, as we've said, have lost track of how to do that in our families or do that in our homes. So death doulas specialize in death support for the person who's dying and also for the family. Sometimes it's company, sometimes it's resources and awareness, sometimes it's facilitating ritual or just planning. But that's a person who specializes in opening up the topic of dying and how you want to do that.
It makes total sense. If there's one for birth, there should be one on the other end as well, right? Of course. So Jill, you have recently, well, I learned through an article that was written about you or included you in the London Times, mm-hmm. that has a headline of Canada is the number one country that is connecting to offering medical assistance in dying. Maybe could you talk? I tried to read the article, but apparently I have to subscribe. And since I'm not a subscriber, I got the headline and then it was like, okay, I'm just going to ask Jill.
Yeah.
What was the nature of the article that was recently published about this topic?
Yeah, I was contacted by the London Times to contribute to an article as the UK is struggling to or wrestling with their policies around medical assistance in dying. And so the title of the article in the UK is like, Canada's the capital of medically assisted death. We have done, I think over 50,000 people have died that way in Canada since the law came into place. And the article went through a series of Canadian people in the process of seeking MAID, as well as some of the prominent people in the UK that have not had access to that service. And one particular politician who actually starved herself and then left a posthumous letter saying, please, United Kingdom, evoke MAID laws, because this is how people are having to end their lives in the absence of policies that exist in other places in the world. And my dad's story and my story was included in that article as an example of kind of a different kind of person than the stereotype you might think of for medical assistance in dying. So in Canada, the studies show that we're all quite comfortable with the idea of MAID for terminal cancer, people in their 80s or their 90s, where you've had a good life and you don't want to suffer anymore. It's like over 80% of Canadians are on board for that being an option at that point in your life. But my dad was 64 when he died. He has three children who are in their 20s and 30s, and he was still pretty strong. And there was a lot of life in him, just not the kind of life that he could tolerate. And so our story was included in that article to sort of round out the understanding of who these rights are for, who this might include, and stimulating the conversation for people, not just in their 80s, but for parents, you know, because I think a lot of people in their 50s and 60s are quick to say, you know, like, oh, if that ever happened to me, you know, if I was ever incapacitated or I couldn't walk or I couldn't speak, something happened to me where I was going to live the rest of my life in a bed, I would want the choice. And that's sort of what the whole world is wrestling with. Should we have the choice or not? And who do our bodies belong to? And who do our deaths belong to? And is death a part of wellness? Is death a part of healthcare? Or does death live at the opposite spectrum? Are we trying to run away from it, or are we trying to support it?
Yeah. And it's a messy subject. It's a very messy political type of subject.
Definitely.
And I'm not equipped to have that conversation because I'm not up to date on all of the various pieces and government involvement in supporting or not supporting MAID. Is there anything that you would like to say about it in terms of being a Canadian and living in the country who seems to get it first, or at least more than most of the rest of the world at this point?
I want to be in the same camp as you, Marilyn, around not pretending to be a political expert or pretending that I have the answers around how to ensure proper policy for something like that. But having lived through the experience with my dad and then seen the impact of sharing that story with people and facilitating panel discussions and large group talks about the issue, I will say that I am in favor of choice, and that it's so important as we discuss things politically to remember that MAID isn't something that will ever be imposed upon anyone. It's not something anyone's going to be forced to do. It's an option. And who should that option be available to, and under what circumstances, is a nuanced topic. And I wanted to include my dad's story in the larger discussion of that, because I think it is a broader inclusivity criteria than just terminal illness and really old age and disability elements and mental capacity and Alzheimer's and all of these things. That's fragile, and I'm not educated or equipped to say that I know what's right. But choice is important, and larger inclusivity for choice with wise safeguards is what we really need from our governments.
Thank you. So, Jill, I want to talk about what you're doing with this. Workshops, retreats, consultations, gatherings to explore the intersection of wellness and mortality. Do you see this in your future? Because you've got the London Times of UK reaching out. The world is listening to you. This is something where there's a lot of respect for you in the work that you have done. You have the lived experience. So what do you think that the road ahead might be for you to in exploring this in more fullness, shall we say?
Thank you for asking that. I am following along with something that feels kind of larger than me. It's like I stumbled into this intersection of wellness and mortality, and I was deep in the wellness world and always fascinated with bodies and their mortality. And then this experience with my dad was a catalyst, some sort of alchemy for this being something that I need to pursue. And what does it look like to pursue the intersection of wellness and mortality? What does it look like to center my work around that? I am following along. So having conversations with you is one step. I was on an incredible panel in the fall at Ted Rogers Cinema Hot Docs talking about medical assistance in dying in Canada and what that might have to do with wellness. And this spring and going into the summer, I'm doing some microdosing of these ideas into some more public offerings. So there's a voice and movement workshop coming up in April on the 5th at a...
I'm going.
Yes.
I've registered. And so call out to the voice and movement workshop, April the 5th.
Well, thank you. That's going to be a 2-hour event on a Friday night, where we're going to talk about bodies and how the way that we connect to and move in our bodies impacts the way that we sound, the way that we make noise or share our voice. And that relationship, that level of mindfulness or felt sensation in our own bodies can only be accessed when we're in touch with the softer realities of what it means to be human, when we're in touch with ease, pleasure, joy, sometimes sadness, which is more, it's mortality. It's like the mm-hmm. secret microdose of mortality into what it means to move well and have a voice. So that workshop is coming up on April 5th. I'm so excited for it. It's at this incredible Pilates studio called SOAR, S-A-O-R, that has this very vibrant community. It'll be a really great space to share these ideas. And then that's like the dessert level offering. And then if you want the full meal, there's a weekend retreat in Caledon, Ontario. It's about 45 minutes outside the city from May 3rd to 5th, where we're going to expand on the conversation of what it means to be well. And that's where we'll have group discussions and more of an exploration of how that lands in our bodies and the way that it makes us scared. And what does wellness have to do with being mortal? And how does dropping in the idea of our mortality to our wellness invigorate our aliveness, our sense of being alive? So that'll be a weekend together in May. And then going forward, I am thinking there will be some opportunities for some online teaching and hopefully some speaking events, because I would love to get up in front of some larger groups and sort of present this talk in a more interactive way so that, you know, I can see eyeballs and respond to questions and start to really dig into how this lands for people. Not just one-on-one anymore, because I'm doing a lot of one-on-one in my office, and I'm looking to do connecting in a larger conversation.
So let's do a call out, shout out for how does the world connect with you, follow you? If they're in the vicinity of Ontario, how do they participate in these things? The workshop on April 5th and the retreat from May 3rd to 5th. What are the call outs here, Jill?
Yeah, the best ways to find me is through my Instagram account, which is jill.bodak. All the information for any upcoming events is always there, and I share little tidbits about bodies and mortality and wellness. And then my website, jillbodak.com, is just a central landing page that has all the offshoots to my book, to my clinical practice, and then to my larger offerings, workshops, retreats, speaking events, and private consultations, because I have been doing some one-on-one work with people looking to bring this into their workplaces? How can their wellness efforts in workplaces be more connected to a felt sense of the body and a microdose of the fact that we're human beings working really hard?
So I also wanted to talk with you about the book, Loved Into Being. They can get that, as you've just mentioned, on your website.
That's right.
Are you still donating proceeds?
I am. So Loved Into Being was published just after my dad died, and the proceeds have been donated to Dying with Dignity Canada and Made House Toronto. Those are the two major end-of-life organizations that I've collaborated with. When you purchase the book on Amazon, those proceeds are donated kind of equally between those two organizations. But I'm also interested in the ways that that book can land in conferences, medical spaces, death doula spaces, and be used there as a fundraiser. So the book is for anchoring these conversations around end-of-life choice, caregiving, wellness, decline. The book is a good tool for anchoring the conversation. And it can be brought into a variety of spaces, and all of it's being used as a way to give back to organizations doing work in those realms. So I'm happy to couple or partner with other end-of-life rights organizations or people doing work at the intersection of wellness and mortality. The book is my offering or my connection point there.
And the book is incredible. I couldn't put it down. It is, all I kept thinking was how, on top of everything that you're going through emotionally and physically right now with your father, are you able to do this? But then after meeting you and talking to you and having you on a couple of episodes of Breaking Brave, it's like, that was your process and it helped you. And by helping you, it's helped so many people in the world.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'll say, the opportunities that we have to work together in person, those body practices are the way that I have learned how to be in touch with mortality and tolerate the intensity of how scary or overwhelming or sad that is. It's by being closer to my own body, not further away from it. And that's something that can be learned, practiced, and integrated into the way that you move through your work day or your parenting day or your exercise.
Excellent. And Jill has very generously agreed to give away 3 copies of this amazing book, Loved Into Being, signed by her. It'd be really nice for a few gifts to go out into the world. People interested in reading that book and winning it as a prize.
Who doesn't love a prize?
Who doesn't love a prize? It's all about prizes and surprises.
Marilyn, I just want to say that I think this show is amazing for holding these kinds of conversations. And it's brave to air a conversation that includes something as provocative as Made, something as tender as mortality, and something as personal as wellness, right? Because we all have our idea. We're all doing whatever cocktail of wellness seems right for you in this moment. It's quite personal. And having someone, you know, in your earbuds shake up those elements or try to bring them all together is brave, right? And you and I talked about, you know, death, and nobody wants to talk about it, but everybody's going to go through it. How do we wrestle with that? How do we make peace with that? And as much as it is the major topic that we want to avoid, it's also what unites us in our humanity. And at this point on the planet, with the amount of political insanity and violence and pain that we see on the news every day, I don't know how we can go forward as a collective if we are not in touch with our own tender bodies, our own mortality, and our own relationship with death, if we lose touch with those things, we will not be able to address together the larger mortal issues that are plaguing our planet at the moment.
Thank you, Jill Bodak. I'd encourage everyone to please, sure, win a copy of Loved Into Being by Jill, or purchase a copy, because it is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful story that will give you a whole new perspective on this topic. Thank you for joining me again, Jill. I'd love to continue to have these conversations. So as you've had more workshops and retreats and speaking opportunities and requests for interviews by international newspapers, we'd love to have you come back, because this is an ongoing conversation.
I would love to come back, Marilyn. It's always such a joy to chat with you. Thank you for this work.
Thank you so much for listening. For updates between episodes, I'd encourage you to join my mailing list, which you can do at either marilynbarefoot.com or breakingbrave.show. At most once a month, at least once a quarter, you'll receive an update on the latest resources, topics, and information I've found either super helpful or amazingly impactful. That's it for now. See you next time.